All right, well, good morning again. As Travis mentioned earlier, we are in the middle of a series. It's actually a 12-week series. This is week three, a series on the spiritual battle that we are engaging in. Now, I think it could be said that we, as a culture, the culture that we live in, for some time has been, we've been declining in our sense of the spiritual. Could argue that we are increasingly naturalistic, view that nature is all that exists, and we tend to deny or avoid the spiritual as a culture. So, for example, in 2023, there was a Gallup poll. This is a poll that was repeated several times in the previous 20 years or so by Gallup, and it was a survey of Americans' beliefs in five spiritual entities, those entities being God, heaven, angels, hell, and the devil. And you can see, obviously, there's a decline there. In 2001, about 90% of Americans claimed a belief in God. And the remaining 10%, some were unsure, some outright denied a belief in God, but about 90% claimed a belief in God. Sadly, that has declined over the couple decades, and in 2023, 74% claimed a belief in God. Of the remaining 26%, about 14% said they weren't sure about God, and 12% again outright denied the existence of God. Still, though, three-quarters of our nation would claim a solid belief in the existence of God. And so still a great majority. It is not unusual, obviously, to believe in God. It is, you could say, typical. However, belief in those other spiritual entities, of course, has lagged behind belief in God throughout. It always does. And specifically, belief in evil and in the devil has lagged behind. So in 2023, 58% of people in America claimed a belief in the devil. And I would say even those that would claim that belief, those of us that may, often we can be kind of embarrassed by that belief. Whereas belief in God is something that perhaps we're more confident in, we can be a little uneasy about sharing a belief in evil, personal evil, in the devil. Belief in God is not strange, it's not peculiar, but belief in the devil, demons, maybe. Nevertheless, although polls reveal this declining belief in the spiritual, sometimes our interests, our pursuits betray us. And sometimes our interests and pursuits reveal beliefs or at least inclinations that are different than what we would claim on a survey. For example, there's been this explosion of interest in, say, the superhero film genre of the last 20 years. So coinciding with this chart and this decline, we are infatuated with little g gods and powers and supernatural power and other worlds. And we've really clung to those kinds of things. And what's especially interesting to me is the explosion of the horror film genre in recent years. Found this chart here. This is measures the popularity of the horror film genre in the U.S. in 2022. And it's kind of fascinating. People were asked how they felt about the horror film genre, whether they loved it, liked it, weren't sure, or disliked it, or hated it. Those that were in the age group of 30 to 44 in 2022, that's many of you, I just missed that, I think, by a few months. So I'm not in there, but you guys love you some horror. Okay, 64% of that, basically that millennial generation, claims to either like or love horror. Okay, the older ones, those kind of the boomers, they don't really like it, but the other generations do, and especially those millennials. In fact, The horror film genre is the fastest growing genre currently in the last 10 years. In 2013, it claimed a 4.87% of the market share of films produced in the United States. In 2023, it was 10.08%. So it more than doubled in about a decade. Okay, for some reason, there has been this increasing fascination with that kind of thing. Also, who would have anticipated the rise and triumph of Skelly? Okay. In October of 2020, 12-foot skeletons popped up everywhere. It was just everywhere. And of course, they have become a year-round cultural phenomenon. And not only these guys, but there's kind of been an explosion of just Halloween decorating in general. Okay, it's just really ramped up. It's been kind of startling. And it just seems to reveal this fascination I think we have as a culture with the uncanny, the macabre, the otherworldly, the paranormal, spiritual power, and even, I would say, evil spiritual power. And not just evil as a concept, but evil personified, personal evil spiritual beings. And I think there are a lot of explanations for this that are posed, but I think one explanation is that we have this intuitive sense of the reality of the spiritual world. There's something in us that just understands that there is something more. And of course, that spiritual world includes God. But I think we also have this intuitive sense that there's even more. That there is even spiritual evil in this world, and it's a reality. Now, if you read the Bible, and if you give the Bible a lot of authority, this is unavoidable. Yeah, the word Satan occurs 53 times in the Bible. The devil occurs 34 times. Demon or demons 78 times. And of course, Satan is a main figure at the very beginning of the Bible. He's a main figure at the very end of the Bible. And he's a prominent figure throughout the life and ministry of Jesus. If we believe the Bible, we must believe that this is a significant part of reality. And that's why we're talking about it right now. Because we do believe the Bible, and we do believe that this is a significant part of reality. And I could admit that as a church, over the years, we may have underemphasized this reality. Not that we've ignored it, not that we've refused to talk about it, but I could admit that we have underemphasized it. And it's easy to underemphasize for a variety of reasons. We can underemphasize it because of the concern about going to certain extremes. We can observe excesses when it comes to this kind of topic. And so we can guard against walking towards or pursuing those sorts of excesses. After all, it is pretty easy to be enthralled with some kind of obscure or controversial questions. And we are very intrigued by questions about, say, demon possession or territorial spirits or words that we should say if we have a confrontation with evil. And these are intriguing questions. You know, we're going to discuss some of those questions as we go along in this series. Those are important questions because I think many of us have had real direct encounters with evil. And so we must discuss some of those questions. However, as we go along, and especially as we begin this series, we want to try to really major on what the Bible majors on. And so although we will discuss some of those kinds of questions as we go along, we're trying to lay a foundation here to begin with. And that foundation is in the armor of God, written about in Ephesians chapter 6. After all, we could consider the book of Ephesians. What was going on there? Paul is writing this letter to this church in the city of Ephesus. And Ephesus, as many of you know, was kind of the epicenter of pagan worship, idolatrous worship. Ephesus, of course, was known for the temple of Artemis and the worship of the goddess Artemis or Diana. And we read about this in Acts chapter 19, along with the book of Ephesians. But this city worshipped Artemis specifically and many, many gods. This was such a central part of the culture in this city. It could be said that if any place opened themselves up to the demonic, it was probably first century Ephesus. In their worship practices, in their idolatry, they would have opened themselves up to a lot of that kind of thing. That's just what they did. But what does Paul give them in the book of Ephesians? He does not give them some sort of ritualistic incantation, but instead he gives them the armor. He gives them the armor described in Ephesians chapter 6. And so as we begin this series, we're going to start there. And we're going to try to understand this armor and consider these types of things are bread and butter when it comes to the spiritual battle. After all, although we do and will have direct confrontations with evil, oftentimes Satan's methods are more subtle. 2 Corinthians 11, Paul is describing false teachers, false apostles. He says, "For such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ, and no wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light." And so often, the strategies of Satan are going to be subtle and even appear good. They might not feel kind of palpably evil. In fact, they may appear noble on the surface. And so we have to train our sensitivities and try to understand those strategies and put on the appropriate armor. And so that's what we're trying to do, especially in these early weeks of this series. So with that said, we're going to read our passage in Ephesians chapter 6. Now, for the first many weeks of this series, we're just taking about a half of a verse per week. Okay, John did that last week, and I'm going to do that again this week. As we discuss each piece of armor that God gives us in this chapter, so we're covering over about 7 weeks, Ephesians 6, 10 through 20. But each week, most of those weeks, we're just examining one particular piece of the armor. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to start at the beginning of this passage in verse 10, and I'm going to read through 14 and today's piece of armor. "So finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his might." And of course, you can open your Bibles up to this as well. I'll have it up here on the screen, but it's on page 979 if you're using a house Bible. "Put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the authorities, against the cosmic powers over this present darkness, against the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand firm. Stand therefore, having fastened on the belt of truth, and having put on the breastplate of righteousness." And then he goes on to describe other pieces of armor that we are to take up or put on. But we're going to focus in on the breastplate of righteousness today. Now, before we get to that breastplate and talk about it, I want to share a few other preliminary thoughts. And first, I just want to remind us that we use protective equipment where it's needed. That's what we do. Whether we're in battle, or we're playing a sport, we use protective equipment where it's needed. So my kids play soccer, so they wear shin guards. And they wear shin guards because they're likely to be kicked in the shins when they're playing soccer. Okay, in that activity that they're engaging in, that's a likelihood. That's what's coming. That's what they have to protect themselves from. They're likely to get kicked in the shins. And when you get kicked in the shins, it hurts. Okay, so it hurts pretty badly. If you've ever been kicked or banged your shin, you'd know that. It's a sensitive area. When we first moved into our current house about 9 or 10 years ago, we had this wooden deck, ground level, just off the patio in our backyard. And this deck had been built over the sprinkler system valves and backflow prevention device. And so this deck was over the guts of the sprinkler system, and it had these couple of wooden panels that you would take off to access those valves. But the deck was old and kind of rotting, and one day I jumped up on that deck, and my foot went through one of those panels and just banged my shin on the wooden edge of the decking there. And I whimpered and whined as it hurt like crazy. Okay, obviously that is a sensitive area. When you get hit on bone with nothing to protect yourself but skin, it's really, really painful. And so that's why soccer players wear shin guards. Now similarly, when we look at this armor that is given, we can understand certain things about how we're going to be hit. Okay, we can understand, I think, certain things about the devil's strategies. Okay, how we're going to be hit, what's likely to occur, and what's going to hurt if we get hit there. And so we might start off by saying this armor reveals something about the strategies of Satan. And we're going to go into those strategies a little bit for a few minutes before we get to the breastplate here, so we can see what the breastplate is protecting us from. So first of all, we were told in this passage in verse 11, we were told to put on the whole armor of God that you may be able to stand against the schemes of the devil. Okay, so he has schemes, there are strategies. There are probably consistent methods that he uses. And in 2 Corinthians 2, it says, anyone whom you forgive, I also forgive. Indeed, what I have forgiven, if I have forgiven anything, has been for your sake in the presence of God, so that we might not be outwitted by Satan. And as a side note, unforgiveness seems to be used pretty powerfully by Satan. For we are not ignorant of his designs. Okay, so he says pretty clearly, we are not ignorant of his designs. We know how he operates. And we have actually quite a bit of information in the Bible about how he operates. Not only what is implied by the armor that we are told to put on, but we see how Satan operates in the narratives in which he is directly involved. And John went through several of those last week when he talked about the belt of truth. You know, narratives like the Garden of Eden and Job and Jesus' temptation. We know something about his designs just through the names or the titles that he's given, which we'll explain some of those a little in a few minutes. But names like Satan or the devil or the destroyer. And, of course, there are statements that directly describe his activities. We can see a lot of those in the Bible. Again, we have quite a bit of information. There are some things that we don't have that much information on that we're just left to surmise some things about this whole topic. But I think we are told quite a bit about how Satan operates, his designs, his schemes. And so I wanted to go through pretty quickly some of those consistent designs, his strategies. And I'm going to list 8 here. And we'll see that the pieces of armor don't always correspond one-to-one to these, but most of the pieces of armor will protect us from one or more of these kinds of designs. And so I'm going to go through 8 of them again. How does Satan operate? Well, number one, through deception. And John, again, he drew this out, I think, in a fantastic way last week. And I'd encourage you to listen to that. When he talked about the belt of truth, of course, that is going to help us combat Satan's deception. But Satan literally means adversary, but is occasionally Satan twists the truth in the Garden of Eden. And so, again, John explained that. The beginning of the Bible, Satan twists. He twists the truth. He deceives. specifically called the deceiver and the father of lies, and he disguises himself as an angel of light, like I just shared a few minutes ago. So deception is a key strategy of his. Accusation is another one. Satan literally means adversary, but is occasionally translated as accuser. He is directly called the accuser of the brothers in Revelation 12:10. And stories like the story of Job highlight Satan's strategy of accusation. So Satan accuses. He slanders. Okay, devil also means slanderer or accuser. And Satan's activity is often associated with slander. Okay, when something is spoke, when a charge is brought, when something negative is spoken about or to, or when somebody is labeled with something, that could be the work of Satan. There's temptation. Satan is specifically called the tempter. He incites and uses specific sins such as anger and sexual immorality. Obviously, he wants to tempt us simply to ignore the laws of God, the laws of God that are for our good and to bring about so much good in our lives. Okay, he tempts us to break those. There's blindness and confusion. It says in 2 Corinthians that Satan has blinded the minds of unbelievers and keeps them in darkness, Acts 20:26. And so especially he especially wants to guard against people understanding and knowing and embracing the gospel. And so he blinds people, he confuses them. In the parable of the sower, it talks about Satan snatching away understanding. And when somebody doesn't understand it, Satan comes down and he snatches away that understanding so that people do not come to belief. So he blinds and he confuses. Destruction is one of his consistent strategies. Satan is called Abaddon or Apollyon, which could be the destroyer. And he brings all kinds of destruction, okay, in this world. It could be even through sickness or even death, as we see in Luke 13 or really throughout the Gospels and in the book of Job. And so he destroys things, even physical things. And he brings about division. You know, sins such as unforgiveness and jealousy are associated with the work of Satan. Those kinds of sins that tend to create wedges between people. Satan's influence over Judas obviously brought betrayal and division. He loves to divide. God loves unity, and so Satan wants to break apart that unity. And then there's just pride and self-promotion. Of course, Satan exalts himself and constantly strives for a high position. That's just his nature. Okay, he wants to grow in power, in authority, in position. And of course, he encourages that in others. And so self-ambition and conceit are associated with the work of Satan. And he tempted Adam and Eve with power and possession that they could be like God. So we aren't unaware, again, of his schemes, his strategies, his designs, although they can be subtle. And sometimes we neglect to identify these things, but we should know them. Okay, God has told us how Satan operates. And so we, again, just want to have our sensitivities trained here and be very aware. And we want to be very careful about participating, of course, in these designs. Okay, if we are participating in or promoting anything that could be labeled with these words, then we want to be very, very cautious, obviously. But we also want to be aware when these designs, these strategies are targeted at us, because they are targeted at us. Now, specifically for today, I would say that these three designs are targeted at us, and the breastplate of righteousness protects us from those. It protects us from accusation, from slander, from temptation, those strategies that the devil operates in. And so, knowing that that's what's going to come at us, those things, we take up the breastplate of righteousness. And so let's talk about that. First of all, the breastplate. Paul would use this image, and his readers would have understood, they would have seen on Roman soldiers this kind of thing. breastplate was made of metal or very thick leather. And of course, it was designed to protect vital organs, to protect your core. Okay, to protect what was vulnerable and what was really meaningful about who you are and the essence of who you are, that core identity in the spiritual sense. You know, the Bible speaks a lot about our heart, kind of that core inner being, the seat of our emotions and our desires and really who we are and how we express ourselves. And it tells us to keep or to guard our heart with all vigilance, for from it flow the springs of life. And the breastplate protects that core. It protects our heart. It protects that inner being. Now, it's interesting because Paul here could have associated a variety of qualities or characteristics with the breastplate, what would protect that core being. But of course, he associates the breastplate with righteousness. Okay, righteousness here. And righteousness, or this breastplate, may be the most related to sort of core identity in these pieces of armor. And so he says to put on the breastplate of righteousness. We are to clothe ourselves with righteousness. That's what he tells us to do. Now, we can talk about righteousness in different ways. I think when we read through the Bible, we see perhaps two different types of righteousness. You could say there's an imputed righteousness or a given or objective righteousness, it's often called. And this is we're talking about a status that is given to us. We are given a righteous status, but there's also a practical or a lived or a subjective righteousness, a righteousness that we live out. Okay, righteousness, of course, it's just the quality of being morally right, but there are these two types of righteousness, an imputed righteousness and a practical righteousness. Now, that imputed righteousness, again, has been given to us by God. In 2 Corinthians 5:21, it says, "For our sake he made him to be sin, who knew no sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God." We just want to camp for a moment on this exchange that is offered us, that Jesus made with us. For our sake, he made him, God made Jesus, to be sin, who knew no sin. Jesus came to this earth, and he did not sin, and he was perfectly righteous. But God made him to be sin. And there was this incredible exchange that happened where God took our sin and all the condemnation that was deserved for that sin, and he placed that on Jesus. And Jesus took that label and that condemnation, the punishment that was deserved for that sin. And he put that on Jesus and carried out that punishment. The righteous died for the unrighteous. But that wasn't all. There was this exchange that was made. And not only was our sin placed on Jesus, but his righteousness was placed on us. And so there wasn't just a debt that was removed, but there was a credit that was given. And this is the remarkable truth of the gospel, okay, that we, as sinners, were given Christ's righteousness. He took our sin on him. And all he asks is for us to receive that exchange, for us to believe, for us to trust, for us to say, yes, Jesus, thank you, and I accept that offer. And he makes that exchange. And so we are imputed, we are given an objective righteousness, our status is changed. And yet there is a lived out practical righteousness as well, that I would say results from that imputed righteousness. 2 Timothy 2:22 says, "So flee youthful passions and pursue righteousness." So it's not just live in or receive that status, but it's pursue righteousness, faith, love, and peace along with those who call on the Lord from a pure heart. Okay, so there is an imputed righteousness. It's being righteous, and then there is a doing of righteousness. It's a practical, lived-out pursuit of doing right things. Now, which is Paul talking about when he references the breastplate of righteousness? I think it must be both, because I think they're inseparable. And really, there's always this interplay, almost this dance between what we could call our justification and our sanctification. Our justification, that part of our salvation that happened in a moment where we were declared righteous. Our sin was taken away. We were given that new status. Rather than sinner, we are now righteous. And again, that happens in a moment. But then there's another part of our salvation that we label sanctification. And it's this process of growing into that status where we become more and more righteous. And those are inseparable. And there's always this back and forth interplay between the two. And I want to draw that out a little bit. Both are necessary in the battle. Practical righteousness demonstrates imputed righteousness. Okay, it's just the evidence. There's an evidence of salvation as we grow in and practice righteousness. 1 John 3:7 through 8. Little children, let no one deceive you. Whoever practices righteousness is righteous as he is righteous. Whoever makes a practice of sinning is of the devil, for the devil has been sinning from the beginning. The reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the works of the devil. Okay, so there's this practice of righteousness. I would say a growing trajectory here. We're growing in righteousness, and it's evidence of a righteous status. Whoever practices righteousness is righteous. Also, we could say that imputed righteousness empowers practical righteousness. Titus 2:11 through 12 says, "For the grace of God has appeared, bringing salvation for all people, training us to renounce ungodliness and worldly passions, and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in the present age." So when that grace, when that salvation appears, it trains. It somehow enables and empowers us to walk in righteousness. And thirdly, practical righteousness prevents the devil from gaining influence. Ephesians 4:26 and 27, and this may be a verse that we share several times throughout this series, says, "Be angry and do not sin. Do not let the sun go down on your anger, and give no opportunity to the devil." This is really interesting in that opportunities are given to the devil. In other translations, it says footholds. Okay, so a foothold or an opportunity is given to the devil, specifically when we sin in our anger. And so, there is an influence that is gained when we sin. Potentially, the devil gains some sort of influence or opportunity to influence us as we sin. In this case, specifically, talking about the sin that can happen in anger. But there is an influence, an opportunity that is gained as we practice sin. And I think this should sober us. You know, of course, there are lots of motivations to not sin. If sin is... Sin hurts. Okay, sin brings about destruction in our lives. Obviously, it dishonors God. But when we bring the spiritual battle into it as well, it kind of raises the level of seriousness here. Because we see that not only does sin have just a natural repercussions, but it also potentially allows Satan to have a greater influence there. And Satan tries to get more and more mileage out of our sin. And he amplifies the effects of that sin. And so again, sin doesn't just have these natural repercussions, but it allows a personal spiritual being to amplify and exaggerate the effects of that sin and gain more and more influence, which again should sober us and should just cause us to take our sin very, very seriously. So with that said, we are told to simply put on the breastplate of righteousness. Okay, there's an active putting it on. There's something practical that we do to clothe ourselves with the breastplate of righteousness. And really, it's just pursuing each of those types of righteousness, both the imputed and the practical. And so, as we close here, We are, as we put on this breastplate of righteousness, we are to renew ourselves in the truth of our imputed righteousness daily. Okay, so just practically, when we think about this, when we think about putting on the breastplate of righteousness, in many ways, it's just a remembrance. Much of the Christian life is about remembering. Okay, that's why God gives us communion, is simply to remember. We are to practice remembering the truths of the gospel. We are to rehearse them in our minds consistently, daily. 2 Peter 1:9 through 10 says, "For whoever lacks these qualities is so nearsighted that he is blind, having forgotten that he was cleansed from his former sins." And he's talking about character qualities that we are to grow in. But if we lack those, we've forgotten that we've been cleansed. We've forgotten our righteousness, our imputed righteousness. "Therefore, brothers, be all the more diligent to confirm your calling and election, for if you practice these qualities, you will never fall." So there's simply a remembrance, a recalling, a rehearsing of these gospel truths. I have been made righteous. Okay, Jesus has imputed his righteousness to me. He's credited his account to me. He's taken away my debt. And that is something that I am to repeat to myself often, every day, as I'm equipping myself for the battle that I am sure to engage in, knowing the consistent designs of Satan, knowing that I will be accused, knowing that I will be slandered. I put on that breastplate of righteousness by simply rehearsing those gospel truths that he has made me righteous. And then secondly, we resolve to put sin to death and live righteously. And Ben, you can go ahead and come back up as I'm sharing here. But we resolve to put sin to death and to live righteously. Romans 8:13 says, "For if you live according to the flesh, you will die. But if by the Spirit you put to death the deeds of the body, you will live." And there is to be this serious resolve of where we put to death sin, where we determine to live righteously. And again, these two types of righteousness, they interact with each other. And this is empowered by our imputed righteousness. But we resolve to put sin to death, knowing the potential danger of our sin. As I just described, that Satan can get so much mileage out of our sins. There is a true spiritual battle, and he wants to amplify the effects of that sin. And so we wake up each morning renewing ourselves in our imputed righteousness and then determining to pursue a lived righteousness. Recognizing that there will be temptations and promptings, and we will go through our day tempted to engage in lustful thoughts, in resentment, anger, unforgiveness. We will be tempted to promote ourselves and walk in these kinds of self-exalting practices. We know those are going to happen. We know those are going to be brought up, and we will be tempted to pursue those. But we wake up each morning with this determination. I'm going to turn from and put to death those sins, and I'm going to turn towards righteousness. So, we know how Satan operates. Okay, we know the consistency of his strategies. We know that we will be accused. We know that we will be slandered. We know that we will be tempted every day. And therefore, every day, we wake up